Kia ora, it's Alistair here from Wilderness. I'm joined by Anna Watson, who traversed Rakiura's Tin Range for our Off the Beaten Track feature in the July-August 2026 issue. Anna is going to read her story, and then we'll have a short Q&A about the trip. Take it away, Anna.
Taking on the Tin Range. Wild tales chase on the heels of any account of tramping on Rakiura, Stewart Island. Kiwi as big as cats, thigh-deep mud, and sinking sand that will suck you to the depths of Doughboy Bay. These tales wind their way around the island's three main tramping tracks, the Rakiura, Northwest, and Southern circuits. They don't even touch the southernmost third of the island. For many years, whenever I gazed at the map of Rakiura, my eye would be dragged past Whakaateawera, Paterson Inlet, to those southern reaches. Remote, rugged, and thickly shrouded in bush, it is practically untouched by tracks and huts. In fact, after having first been proposed in 1981, the south is currently being gazetted as a wilderness area. The Tin Range marches down the spine of southern Rakiura to Pikiha Titi, Port Pegasus. On the topo map, it seems to beckon with an inviting finger. But as I started to read into routes on the range, it became clear that wild tales only grew wings down there. I read of tents whipped away by wicked winds in the night. More than one account told of sub-Antarctic mists gathering as thick as any insurmountable wall. Almost everyone agreed that to drop off the tops of the Tin Range is to resign oneself to swimming uselessly through interminable bush. A true challenge, then. I was hooked on the idea. As I read more, I also learned scraps of the history of the southern reaches of Rakiura. The bush to the east of the Tin Range was the last refuge for kākāpō before they were moved to Whenuaho to escape the claws of feral cats. A hardy knot of puku nui, southern dotterel, stubbornly continues to breed on the alpine tops. The southern tips of the range contain remnants of a doomed tin rush. What an intriguing place. Last summer, I at last gathered a group of four friends to attempt our hikoi south. We set aside 7 days and could do little more than pray to Tawhiremātia for good weather. Almost all trip reports mentioned chartering a boat to Port Pegasus to save on an out and back along the Tin Range, but a mulish part of me felt like this would be cheating. We decided to start at Rakiahua Hut, ascend the Tin Range, and make our way south to Port Pegasus. We would then fashion a return loop by dropping off the range for a bush bash to Doughboy Bay, where we would rejoin the southern circuit to Mason Bay, and finally, Freshwater Hut. Our friend and local water taxi captain, Raki, dropped us off at Rakiahua Landing on a still, grey day. Almost immediately, Selena stepped right into one of the infamous Rakiura bogs, which sucked her in almost to the hips before she managed to haul herself out. The sticky, smelly mud clung to her for hours. 15 minutes down the track, we arrived at the turnoff to the Tin Range, marked by an ancient dock sign warning hikers that the route is unmaintained. We hauled ourselves up the light trail through the bush and pushed out into the open a couple of hours later. Having read numerous warnings about the scarcity of water on the tops, James had generously lugged a 6-litre water bladder up the 400-metre climb, only to find a perfectly clear stream just beyond the bush line. Go figure. In 2012, DOC drafted a Rakiura National Park Management Plan. Its descriptions of southern Rakiura are arrestingly poetic. It describes the Tin Range as etched in the horizon, arising mysteriously in the distance, above Paterson Inlet, Whakaateawera. We made camp that night perched on the bushline just above the inlet, feeling like we had ascended onto the wild southern core of peace and solitude. The tops around us were broad and rolling, the ground underfoot springy and dotted with delicate white alpine flowers. We sipped celebratory bush-style margaritas to celebrate Tom's birthday and watched as the view north towards Hananui, Mount Anglem, was slowly swallowed by an advancing mist. Sure enough, When we awoke on day two, our world had shrunk. The forecast had promised a cool breeze and little to no precipitation. Instead, mist lay heavily on the hills we needed to walk over. We set off towards Table Hill, using a mix of map, compass, and the Topo app to keep on track. Long ago, someone had hunted down a treasure trove of obelisks. And these narrow whitish stones, and sometimes a sturdy stick, were planted in the ground at irregular intervals. As we climbed Blakey's Hill, the mist swelled and thickened until we seemed to be in the heart of a rain cloud. The temperature dropped and visibility shrank to less than 50 metres. The tin range was testing our mettle. By mid-morning, we were cold and soaking wet. We squeezed into a leatherwood bush in the saddle between Blakey's and Mount Allen to regroup. I was wearing every item of clothing I had packed for walking, and still my teeth chattered. We were only at 480 metres elevation. How was it so cold? Over a hot brew, we debated our options. No flat ground to camp here. We would have to get moving soon. Did we dare push on to the tarn in this unrelenting weather? Return to last night's campsite and wait out this icy rain? We decided to stay close together and push on. Ta Whetamātea must have been feeling generous, and within an hour, the clags started to lift. We caught glimpses of piercing blue ocean to the west. As we made our way up the swampy slopes of Mount Allen, a tiny bird zoomed in front of us, then scuttled sharply to the left. A pukunui. We picked our way carefully along the route, watching our feet and allowing the bird to draw us away from its nesting ground. In the course of the day, we would see 10 pukunui, roughly 10% of the entire population. By lunch, we were enjoying scraps of sunshine by the unnamed tarn beneath Mount Allen. By late afternoon, I had gone from having numb fingers to a sunburnt nose. We found a campsite just beyond Granite Knob, overlooking the swath of bush gliding towards the eastern coast of Rakiora. A scattering of huge mounds rose out of the land below, each bearing a magnificent cap of granite that at some point long ago had cracked into dragon scales. We were within half a day's walk of the southern end of the Tin Range. All going to plan, we would set up camp at the old MacArthur's Creek Dam before lunch for the following day. Bearing out that bitterly cold weather 6 hours earlier had been worth it. Our final leg of the Tin Range got off to an excellent start when Annie startled a kiwi nosing around the flat tops high above the headwaters of MacArthur's Creek. I spared a thought for the miners as we made our way down Tin Range Surveyor's Track. When it was cut, incessant rain combined with the peaty ground had made the track a veritable mudslide, but here we were, stripping off layers as we descended excitedly to the coastline. The day was bright, with blue overhead and barely a whisper through the rimu surrounding us. When we reached the bush-clad shore, I spied the perfect little swimming cove, but reared back in shock as a sea lion suddenly appeared in the very spot I was eyeing up, giving me a stern look before sinking beneath the surface again. We settled for lunch on the bank and admired the dappled water through the trees. As I munched a tuna wrap, I contemplated the view. To our southwest were the Fraser Peaks and the two granite majesties of the range, Kakakuta and Tu Pōuri, commonly known as Gog and Magog. We resolved to return with more time or a pack raft. After 2 nights of questionable camping sites, the dam at MacArthur's Creek felt like a palace. We bathed in the creek and had a leisurely dinner in the level clearing. We had achieved our main objective, to tramp the Tin Range, but we knew that the next 2 days could well prove the most challenging. We had found just one account of a route to Doughboy Bay, and it was hardly encouraging, grimly stating, "Good luck," to those foolhardy enough to attempt to make their way through 15 kilometres of dense bush. Our first taste of Rakiora bush bashing started mid-morning the following day. We had trudged back up to 0.637 on the Tin Range, and as we dropped a couple of contours towards the west, we popped out of the swirling clag. The views opened up to a riot of valleys below, with no easy way out to the coast. We braced ourselves and pushed into the alpine scrub. It required full commitment, eyes scrunched up, feet scrabbling, shoving our way through the leatherwood. Somehow, we managed to find a rhythm. Although that first band of bush was definitely the worst, the forest remained largely implacable. We delighted in finding occasional ancient trail markers, never enough to rely on, but sufficient to feel validated in our route choices. They came in all sorts: green rope, strips of blue plastic, fishing net, orange twine, the tiniest scraps of pink tape. On occasion, in particularly thick bush, we followed blazers. It became a treasure hunt, triumph rippling through all of us when someone found the next mark. It took 2 full days to reach Doughboy Bay. We arrived weary, bruised, and bubbling with pride, and broke out onto the sand dunes, whooping with delight. We had tramped an epic 5 days without seeing a soul. A kiwi scampered under our feet in the broad afternoon sunlight, at first perturbed and then rather carefree as we stalked behind it. We trudged along the Crescent Bay towards Doughboy Hut, skirting the infamous patch of sinking sand. The hut was crammed with herpetologists on holiday, hoping to spot the rare Harquin gecko. We devoured dinner al fresco, cheerfully ignoring the rain dripping through the trees overhead. Doughboy Bay was the warm-up, I thought to myself, as we made a start along Mason Bay on day 6. The bay spans 14 kilometres in total, although thankfully the southern circuit travels less than half of that. The hard sand was unforgiving, as was the wind that whipped grit into our eyes. Māori call it Te Onoroa, the long beach. They've been coming here for eons. An intricately carved tohu, a canoe prow, discovered at Mason Bay, is thought to be pre-European, and the gutter, a spectacular inlet at the southern end of Te Onoroa, has yielded discoveries of buried waka, middens, and other evidence that point to this beach being one of the southernmost prehistoric Māori settlements in Aotearoa. On our hikoi, all we saw was ocean trash. Bits of green rope and strips of pale blue packing plastic caught my eye. They looked familiar, and we realised the trail markers we had followed for the past couple of days must have been salvaged from this beach. We eventually made it to Mason Bay Hut. It felt fitting that on our last night we would get to sleep in bunks. Our final day would be a mere 3 hours on the boardwalks of Chocolate Swamp and through the Manuka Flats to Freshwater Landing. As we passed the historic buildings of Island Hill Homestead the next morning, I took stock of our trip. We had walked more than 80 kilometres, much of it through formidable mud or gloriously deep bush. We had enjoyed the improbable experience of spotting kiwi and pukunui on the inhospitable tops of the Tin Range, and we had sighted the mystical granite figures of Kakakuta and Tupouri rising above the southern reaches of Pikiha Tiiti, Port Pegasus. As promised by all the tales I'd collected over the years, it had been a journey through time, a glimpse of Aotearoa through the ages.
Thanks, Anna. What a great story and trip, with a bit of type 2 fun thrown in there by the sounds of it.
Absolutely.
Can we go back to the beginning and talk about why you chose to visit Rekiura and traverse the Tin Range?
Yeah, I would love to. So Rekiura is a really special place for me. My grandfather lived in Dipton, which is very deep south, farming country, and he often travelled over to Rekiura as a boy with his family. And when he was a teenager, he actually decided to purchase a little plot of land on Butterfields Beach, which is about 10 minutes walk from the village. And he purchased it with the earnings he made from shooting rabbits and selling off the rabbit skins. So our whānau was very lucky to have a crib over there, and I've been going there ever since I was very small. It's a very special place to me, and it just feels like what I imagine Aotearoa was pre-humans arriving on the whenua.
What a fabulous connection. Well, it seems most people who visit that tin range, they either traverse north to south or south to north. I just wondered why you wanted to also throw in the route to Doboy Bay and continue on the southern circuit rather than maybe just catch a water taxi back from, you know, either end of the range.
Well, it definitely would have been easier for us, I think, if we had taken a boat down to Port Pegasus. And from my research, I think it is relatively easy to get a charter boat if you so choose. We did briefly look into the cost of a helicopter to drop us down down south. But there was just some part of me that decided that that would be cheating, and it's entirely made up as a notion. But once I got it into my head, I thought we just had to get around on our own two feet. And in fact, our original route choice was to do the tin range and then bush bash our way to Gog and Magog and then come back up over the tin range and back again. And this was very ambitious for two reasons. One being that the tin range is awful at best when it comes to weather. So hoping for two goes at a traverse with a good weather window was very optimistic. And then the second part, which really was the fatal blow, was that stepping along from where we'd land up in Port Pegasus through to Gog and Magog would take 4 days round trip from what we could tell from the very few trip reports we've been able to put our hands on, one of which is actually one that Sean Barnett did and wrote up in The Wilderness a number of years ago. So we realised that we were perhaps biting off too much that we can chew in terms of days that we would need, and instead looked at other options. Now, my friend Tom, who was a member on this trip, has a very special love for bush bashing. And once he found this route from the tin range down onto Doboy Bay, we just knew we couldn't convince him otherwise. We had to do it. And I guess it did make sense because the other three in the party also hadn't been on the Southern Circuit before. I was the only one who has done it. So it just felt like the right decision, if a little questionable.
Oh, that's hilarious. I mean, in hindsight, would you rethink that bush bash, or are you pleased you did it?
Well, it really depends who I talk to. I really enjoyed it, and so did all of us who were on this trip together. It was actually awful. Like, I say that we found trail markers, but there would be no way that you could rely on those. You would just get lost for days. And in fact, when I told Mum that we were doing this particular route, she told me about a tramping party she knew at uni who had got lost in there for days and ran out of food because there's just no landmarks. You can't see anything. The land is too low-lying. There's actually a couple of river valleys where the water goes inland rather than out. And the bush is just so dense that you're literally fighting it all the time. So I wouldn't say it's fun, but we managed to enjoy it anyway. And I would probably be very hesitant in recommending it as a route unless people have really good bush navigation skills. And I was lucky enough that we had three former God Zone athletes in our team. So it was we felt safe in being able to navigate it, but it is definitely type 2 fun.
I did wonder about your navigation through that section. I mean, was it GPS or compass, a bit of everything?
It was actually everything. We had printed out some maps, and I actually put some bush bingo on the back of the maps just for a little bit of light relief on those tough days. So see what we could tick off on the bingo cards. So we had that in our compass, and then we also had our topo apps with a GPX file that we had happened to stumble upon in our research, and then all of us were playing a a role, I guess, in the navigation. So we were all always on, and we would have Tom on the map and the compass, and he would sort of be leading out, but then the rest of us would fan out to see if we could find any, either a good route through the thick bush, or little trail markers or blazes. And we were just, I don't think we had proper conversations, because all we were chatting about was where are we and where should we go next. And I think because you could be in the bush for so long, like, I would just never recommend relying only on your topo map or your phone. Yeah, because it's just unforgiving environment just due to being so remote, I guess.
It sounds like a real team effort. Can you explain bush bingo?
Yes. So I was at a hut before Christmas, and I can't remember which one it was. It was in Lewis Pass somewhere. And in the hut, along with all the great copies of, you know, the Wilderness Magazine and the Hut Book, there was this bingo card, and it had like a grid of 3x4 pictures on it of different birds and flora and fauna that you could find in that particular area. So the idea is, I think, for the kids to go out and try and find these, you know, a little korimako, a bell bird, or a particular orchid if it's the right time of year. And we thought that was really cool. So I made one for our trip, and I had things, I had a kiwi on there, I had whitetail, which is the deer that hang out down there. I had the harquin gecko, which unfortunately we didn't see, but we did see the herpetologist that saw it. So maybe that's like a proxy. And then leatherwood. I mean, we spent a lot of time in leatherwood, so I didn't really need to put it on the bingo card, but it was just a cool way to like have a little bit of fun. And also I quite like learning about the area I'm moving through. So yeah, bingo, I think it's a real go-getter.
Sounds neat. Sounds like a lot of fun. So how did the gear stack up, Anna? Like, you mentioned at one point you were quite cold on the Tin Range and all that bush bashing. I'm just wondering, you know, did you need anything in particular, or were you happy that you had a particular gear, and or you wish you'd brought something that you'd left at home?
Well, we knew that it would probably be cold, because the conditions really can become sub-Antarctic once you leave Paterson Inlet. And so I had brought all of my winter tramping layers, and it's very rare that I will find myself wearing everything except for what I need to save for sleeping. Yet here I was on the Tin Range, which is like so low elevation wise.
Yeah.
And I was wearing everything and visibly shaking as we were having our cups of tea and figuring out what to do. So I think maybe I'll take like even another fleece, although I had like probably 4 warm layers just for my, you know, my torso. And then the other thing I had thought about on reflection was, you know, those bivy bags that you can kind of like put up like a parachute and then you tuck in, and like, I think it's a bothy bag. I should invest in one of those, because that would have been perfect for our situation where we just needed a bit of a hooey to decide what to do next.
And just shelter out of the wind or the elements a bit.
That's right. And because you could just wait for longer, which would have been perfect, because it turns out that the weather started to lighten up. So I've actually put that on my savings list to buy as my next piece of gear. We had tents. There's no accommodation at all on the Tin Range, so that is a must. So we had really good tents. And then the other thing that we brought, which was a bit unusual, was gardening gloves, because we knew we were going to be doing a lot of bush bashing, and it can actually be quite tough on your hands. So I really recommend it. Those bushes can be quite spiky, and we didn't have enough gloves for like a full pair each, but even just one glove to be able to pull the bushes out of your face or your, you know, wherever it's landing up on your body was super handy. So yeah, hot tip if you find yourself bush bashing.
That is some good advice. Thanks. I did the Southern Circuit a few years ago now, and the highlight for me, I think, was just coming off Mason Bay and rounding a corner in the track, and right there was a kiwi just you know, plodding along. What were the highlights for you in terms of wildlife? Because you did see some pretty neat birds.
Yeah, the kiwi down at Rakiura are really special. And in fact, I remember when I was small, we didn't really see kiwi around the village at all. You really had to be on a tramp, like whether we would go to Port William or more likely on the southern or the northern circuit would you see kiwi. And now when I'm down there, I see them on the way home from the pub and they just hang out around the village. And it's quite amazing and a real testament to the work that's going on down there to protect them. So they're pretty special, but I think the wildlife that really made the trip for me this time were the pukunui. So the southern dotterel, the only dotterel, southern dotterel left in Aotearoa. And the more I learn about them, the more I'm amazed. They're just these like kind of crazy, really hardy little birds who used to be found all along the southern Alps of Aotearoa, just breeding up there, which is crazy. And then they would come down to the river flats on the off season. And for whatever reason, they're still on Rakiura. And they've had a really tough time because feral cats feast on them. And there's an awful lot of feral cats down in Rakiura. It's crazy. I see them when I go to hunting huts and I just can't believe that they're so far from the village. So they feast the pukunui, which is really sad. And then amazingly, Doc has filmed whitetail, which is the deer that reside down at Rakiura, feeding on the nests and the eggs of pukunui up on the tops, which is amazing for two reasons. One, deer are generally vegetarians. And two, down at Rakiura, whitetail are generally known to stay about 400 metres within the shoreline because that's where the best feed is. Yet here they are on the tops of the tin range, literally taking away these cute little birds. So Doc has been doing some amazing work to try and bring this population back up. And in fact, they started a first ever 1080 program last year and the results this season have been incredible. From about 100 dotterel when we were doing the tin range, the count now is 160, which is an amazing jump.
That's a big increase. Yeah. And you saw 10% of the birds, you said, of the population. That's kind of scary, isn't it? And seems so fragile.
I know. That's so fragile. And they're so alone up there. And they're really cute. Like they'll pretend to break a wing and kind of, you know, dance in front of you and be like, aren't I tasty? And try and draw you away from their nesting ground, from their really silly nests, which are like two twigs on the ground. Like they're like very smart, but at the same time, so silly. I love them.
Oh, wow. I'm really intrigued about the trips you do, Anna, because they're always so interesting. Wilderness readers might know them from past issues where you've visited every hut in the Tararua in one very long trip and you followed your mum's footsteps to George Sound Hut. How do you plan your trips and why do you go for these trips that seem to have a really neat element of story behind them?
I just love thinking creatively, I think, about the trips that I do, and especially being in like a really interesting but ultimately an office job, I think being in the outdoors is just so much more precious to me. And having a fun or quirky or kind of special reason for being outdoors just adds this this next layer for me. And on top of that, I really like a huero, a challenge. And if I have a sense of trepidation about what I'm planning on doing, it's really good. Like, I love it. It's so motivating. And I'm fully prepared to fail. But, like, I end up most of the time convincing at least one other person to come along with me on, you know, whatever it is. And I am lucky that I have quite a good group of friends who are up for challenges and doing crazy things or things that are a little bit different. So that really helps. And then My mum was a big tramper, and I will ring her and say, I've got this new idea. What do you think? And she's great. She has this great balance of being really excited for me and then also just dropping in like a few survival stories to just make sure that I'm really thinking about the risk or how much I'm biting off, which I think is a good balance. Yeah, I think the unique element to any adventure just makes it that much more memorable. And there's so many things to do in Aotearoa and our outdoors that this just feels like an amazing way to make the most of it.
I like how you discuss it with your mum. Is there any chance you might go for a trip with your mum on, you know, one of your more exciting adventures?
I do actually take her tramping once a year now. We've done it for a few years. And I love it because she's also very artistic. So afterwards, she sends me like photos and drawings or kind of scrapbook like images that she's kind of glued together of different elements of the walk. So it's a very special thing to be able to share with mum.
How nice. Just going back to this Tin Range trip, Anna, if anyone wants to follow in your footsteps, I wondered if you could offer some advice around organisation and the logistics, because you do have the water taxi. You've even got to get to Stewart Island, which can be, it's a bit out of the way.
Yeah, it's a bit of an epic trip. So to get down to Rakiora, you can either take the ferry from Bluff, which is about an hour, and that's always my preferred mode of transport because you can take as much gear as you want on there, which is really great. Or you can take the plane from Waihopai in Vicargo, which takes about 20 minutes, and it's really little and cute, and you get this amazing view. And they actually cost about the same these days. So it is quite an effort to get down to Rakiora, but then once you're there, it's so amazing. Like it's kind of worth that extra day and the cost of getting there. The village itself, there's lots of accommodation, whether it's the motels or a lot of the houses are now on Airbnb, but for a long time you could only see them on like Book a Batch. And the water taxi that I use is our really good friend Raki. He runs a water taxi business called Rakiora Adventures. And every time I ring him up with a request, he's up for it, which is great because he also takes us to our hunting huts and we, you know, have to go to these kind of crazy places, and he just like knows the island like the back of his hand. So very good friend to have down there. And in terms of the island itself, like it's a really well set up village, but if you're bringing dehi food, I would purchase it in advance and bring it over in a food box. There's a really well equipped Foursquare there, which does have everything you want and very reasonable prices, but just something to be aware of in terms of the range that they have down there. It's still a very small supermarket. And then I think one of the most important things to consider is the weather, because in the Tin Range in particular, because as soon as you leave Paterson Inlet and start going further south, the weather is really unpredictable. The forecast, like we couldn't rely on our forecast that we had, and the amount of wind that can come through, it's just so exposed, and it's quite deceptive because of the low elevation. And on the map, it looks like really nice, broad rolling tops. But if that mist comes in together with the wind and or the rain, you could easily fall off a spur by, you know, getting lost or disorientated. And then the number of accounts of people having to camp out on there that I read about, where they're tents were almost, or in fact were, ripped away by the wind because there's not really any shelter. A couple of camping spots that we made up, and one of them we had to send Tom to dive down into the bushline to find us water. So I think you do need a really good level of confidence in your navigation and your weather reading skills, which for me took like 10 years. I wanted to do this trip 10 years ago, but I knew that I had to work up to it. So that's really good food for thought. And then, as we discussed with the bush bash to Doughboy Bay, it probably takes a very special person to want to do that.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Anna. Really appreciate it. And all the best for your next trip.
Thank you. Mā te wā.